It's the week of the big ruling, the big milestone, and the big walk back.
But one thing I don't think we need is bars open 23 hours a day.
Probably tens of thousands of dollars, close to 100 grand out of my pocket.
It's also the week of the big change.
We're really excited to turn the keys over to FIFA in the next week.
Get ready for the week's biggest local stories and newsmakers straight ahead.
Week in Review is made possible through the generous support of Bob and Marlise Gourley, the Francis Family Foundation, through the discretionary fund of David and Janice Francis, and by viewers like you. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Nick Haynes, and we're thrilled to have you with us again on our weekly journey through the Metro's most impactful, confusing, and downright head-scratching local news stories. Hopping on board the Week in Review bus with us this week from KCUR News, local government reporter Savannah Hawley-Bates, and the station's chief political analyst, Brian Ellison. From the world of television news, KSHB political reporter Charlie Keegan, and former Star staffer, now Mr. Kansas City Stack on Substack, Dave Helling. Now, we were told to expect a high-stakes legal drama this week as Missouri's newly redrawn congressional map headed for a final showdown at the Missouri Supreme Court. But no sooner did it begin, it was all over. In an ultra-fast decision, the seven-member court unanimously upheld the Republican-friendly map, threatening the future of Kansas City Congressman Emmanuel Cleaver and dealing a blow to Democrats nationally in what has been a string of redistricting setbacks this week. But I'm amazed that they heard the case and ruled so fast. Was that a record? I mean, did they even deliberate? It seemed like they were only there for about a few minutes, Charlie.
It happened a lot faster than I expected, but maybe I should have expected it, right? This is a, you know, a very Republican-backed map, Republican justices, judges, and they seem to all get on the same page rather quickly.
This was the highest court in Missouri. Does that mean this spells the end of Emmanuel Cleaver's political future, Brian?
Well, I think that is a question. I mean, I think he has a much more uphill battle now. On the other hand, I don't think we're even nearly finished with the conversations about this. This did mark the end of the road for some of the legal elements of the challenges to redistricting, but there are other conversations still going on, and there's also the voters. We do know that the measure will likely have the necessary signatures to get on the ballot. It could be that there's some resolution of that, and that possibly by November we're looking at different districts again. We just don't know.
Dave.
Yeah, that the referendum now is the last piece of this puzzle, but it is very much up in the air in terms of what impact that's going to have. Because in essence, the Supreme Court said, look, the map is legal, constitutional, but the referendum process is still underway. And if there are enough signatures, as Brian and others suggest, if there are enough signatures and they're certified, the court said the new map is suspended as of December 9th of last year, based on that petition process, and therefore the old map would be in effect for November, if that's indeed when the referendum is to be. The Secretary of State, Denny Hoskins, has said, I'm going to take all the time I need to certify these signatures. That's possible, perhaps likely, in August, the day of the primary. So what we're looking at, theoretically, is the new map for the primary and the old map for the general election, and that will be something to watch.
We most recently heard from Emmanuel Cleaver before this decision to say he was not doing any changes whatsoever to how he was campaigning. He wasn't giving one second thought to it. He was going to stick with his district and campaigning, not to where the new district is, which is almost to the city limits of, like, Jefferson City and Columbia. Has he changed his tune now?
You know, after the ruling, he said that he was looking forward to running for the seat and to, you know, hearing from the voters. He said he trusts the voters to, one, vote for him and also to vote against these new maps. So I think he's also sort of waiting and seeing, but he's certainly, you know, going to try his hardest to keep the seat for his 12th term.
I'm not sure he sounds quite as confident as he once did. I think he recognizes he's going to have an uphill battle if the new map is the one in November.
Yeah, as a practical matter, the Republican Party will do its best to string out the certification process for signatures on the petitions, because the longer they can go, the less likely it is that the old map would be in effect for November. They want to stretch it out a little bit. And so that's why, Nick, The decision of the court that came so quickly, which you started out this discussion with, is actually a critical piece of this, because the court was in essence saying to the Republican Party, we can move on this pretty fast. So if you don't certify these signatures and someone takes you to court, as will inevitably happen, we can decide in a couple of hours to make you certify those petitions and put the old map into place.
And even this week, we heard Secretary Hoskins be a little bit coy when he was asked a question about whether he might determine that the whole idea of a referendum on a redistricting process is illegal and then not accept the referendum at all,
and so,
which would require more legal.
As I reported today, there is a footnote in the opinion that says we haven't decided whether it's legal, but these are the reasons it could be, and it doesn't qualify.
We've got a lot of things going on this program today, but I will say this. What I found was actually the most fascinating quote was from the Secretary of State, who said, you know, in 2028, we could redistrict again and start targeting the St. Louis district that is heavily Democratic as well.
Now that the U.S. Supreme Court has kind of walked back some Voting Rights Protection Act that was protecting the first district that represents St. Louis because of racial lines, is no longer.
So just like stadiums and things like that, this is going to be one of those perennial issues we might be hearing on this program.
And Missouri has a referendum process. That's how it's different from Virginia and other states. Missouri can put the map on the ballot if they gather enough petitions. So if they redistrict again next year, you can expect a petition drive of some sort.
All righty. Now, is there any better way for Kansas City to welcome World Cup fans than by approving nearly around-the-clock booze sales? Now, city leaders are beginning to sober up to the downsides of a new state law allowing bars and liquor stores to sell alcohol 23 hours a day during the tournament.
So Kansas City, we are all excited about what comes ahead this summer. But one thing I don't think we need is bars open 23 hours a day.
Close to $100,000 out of my pocket. This was going to be a huge help, And all of a sudden that rug swiped up. Oh, sorry, guys. I think you guys should be in bed. The state gives you the green light to stay open till 5 to generate extra income. Why wouldn't you?
Well, Mayor Lucas pushed an ordinance this week, opting out of that 23-hour drinking during the World Cup and keeping closing limits in place. Until that is, he got pushback from bar owners. Now, I thought he was so concerned that this was going to cause crime, this was going to cause public disorder and lots of problems on our roads, and yet he walked that back pretty fast this week. Was he not expecting any pushback from bar owners?
You know, I'm sure he must have expected pushback, especially, you know, after facing the tiny liquor ban, bottle ban that was earlier. But I think, you know, in council chambers and committee on Tuesday, they talked about, you know, most of the crime in entertainment districts that happens towards closing time, 3 a.m. in those entertainment districts. But yes, the ordinance was amended, and what they'll be voting on is now, I guess, sometimes 21-hour, sometimes 23-hour liquor sales. And so essentially liquor permits in Kansas City either end at 1:30 a.m. or 3 a.m. Now all of those will now be able to end at 3 a.m. during the World Cup. And then in entertainment areas like Westport, they can close at 3 a.m. or 5 a.m., sorry, if they show a security plan to the city.
So what does that actually mean? I saw that line, but I mean, what is that? Is that putting a bouncer at the door? What is a security plan? In the in British pubs, that would be having plastic glasses, so somebody's just smashing you in the face. That would be a security plan.
I bet that would probably qualify here in this case. It is just in the ordinance, one sentence that says, please submit a security plan, and it doesn't give any real examples of what they're looking for there.
But I think most people would say, boy, 3 o'clock, though, is still an incredibly generous amount of time. Aren't they still going to get a lot of trouble during that period of time?
You know, that is my concern, Nick. I don't know what Dave Helling and I are going to do at 4 a.m. Planning on being at the bar, but now we have to leave at 3, and so it's very confusing.
And it's also interesting that the city is now moving full steam ahead with this 23-hour drinking rules, just as one of downtown's oldest and most iconic eateries is now shutting its doors at night because of rising crime. Town Topic, which is open 24 hours a day, has announced it's now closing at 8 o'clock every night to protect its staff. That seems at odds with what we're now doing with the bars and nightclubs and liquor stores.
Or congruent. Yeah. You know, the same idea here, that if you stay up into the early morning hours, there is inevitably, in most urban places, and certainly in Kansas City, a security risk, a safety risk, which the Town Topic story illustrates for us. And I think that's what the mayor was getting at. And but he, in the face of opposition from bar owners who think they can make more money that way, sort of backed away and came up with this new proposal. You know, the policing of the World Cup will be a fascinating thing to watch, because it won't be just Kansas City, Missouri police. They're bringing in security and officers from around the region. And, you know, there's a potential for problems early in the morning, or perhaps it'll just be very safe and quiet. As I said on the show before, Nick, if you get England and Argentina in the same bar at 4 in the morning, I'm not sure that's going to be the safest thing.
I think it's interesting here, though, is that, you know, the deal with these, the time that liquor sales end, and also with Town Topic closing its parking lot, is, one, prioritizing safety of residents in the city amid a lot of these late-night crimes, but also, I think, in the mayor's case, trying to thread the needle in people still making a profit on the World Cup. This amendment comes, you know, after projections for hotel occupancy and flights are down from, you know, maybe the rush that we thought, that officials thought they'd have here for the World Cup. They're still saying there will be 650,000 visitors. Yeah. That's yet to be seen. But I think after what, you know, a failure the NFL draft was for the local small business community, there's also this tension of making sure that other people and business owners make money during this.
I think that's a great point. In fact, we did a forum this week at the Plaza Library, which you can see on this program next week, which includes the police chief, but a lot of small business owners coming to the microphone there, absolutely anxious over how are they going to make any money out of this? When are we going to know when these visitors come? That was one of the underlying storylines there. I try, though, not to dial up the outrage meter on this program. So despite what you might see on your evening news, I should point out that violence has actually fallen sharply in Kansas City. The figures for the first 3 months of the year are now out, and homicides are down 25% compared to this time last year. Robberies dropped 38%, and rapes fell 20%. So since we never got a satisfying explanation, though, as to why crime in Kansas City had risen so sharply, are we any the wiser why the numbers are now going down?
Well, I think, first of all, I would caution us not to read too much into any one year's numbers, especially part of a year. I think we've made this mistake before. We say murders are way up, then we say murders are way down. Statistically, over time, we need to look a little more. We need to take a step back. But I do think one of the things we are seeing is that the pandemic represented a sort of a high point, a peak in violent crime, and we are seeing a gradual decline since then. I think that's fair to say. I don't think we have enough information, Nick, to say whether that's the result of any particular crime prevention program. And indeed, most of those kinds of programs, experts would say, you have to look 5 years, 10 years out to see the real impact.
Now, she certainly took her time, but Charisse Davids finally made it official this week. She will run for a re-election for Congress in the Kansas 3rd District. Davids had been teasing a potential Senate run against Republican Roger Marshall. The Kansas Reflector news site claims there's a message here. After both Davids and Governor Laura Kelly passed on challenging Marshall, if the two most talented and agile Democratic politicians they write in Kansas don't want to run, they probably don't think the race is especially winnable. Is that the take-home message, Dave?
Well, it's part of the message. I mean, it's been true for Democrats, not just Laura Kelly and Charisse Davids, but going way back, Kathleen Sebelius never ran for the Senate. John Carlin never ran for the Senate. Dan Glickman never. All very well-known, popular Kansas Democrats have walked away from that race because Republicans have won every seat since 1932. So I think that Roger Marshall remains the overwhelming favorite. I think Charisse Davids not only recognized that, but understood she would be walking away from a relatively safe House seat that would cause problems for Democrats. On the other hand, the environment is so pro-democratic across the country that if Democrats can't run a credible race in Kansas this year, they may never be able to. This is the time. Roger Marshall is perceived as a mediocre senator. The farm economy is a disaster. Trump is highly unpopular in Kansas. Democrats and independents are growing in Johnson County. This is the year. If it doesn't happen, it may never happen.
You know, I think that might be why Democrats do seem to be turning to a candidate like Adam Hamilton. The establishment candidates have a proven record of not winning in Kansas. I think there is an element of sort of throwing spaghetti at the wall here and saying we got to try something different. Adam Hamilton, as a non-traditional politician, as one who was considering running as an independent, does represent something different. Whether that's enough to overcome the Republican strength is the question.
But Charisse Davids would have had, one would think, an ability to run a race against Roger Marshall and at least make it close, and she decided not to. I think there may be a reason.
Now, next week on the program, we are expanding to an hour as we bring you Kansas City's big World Cup decision makers on the program. That means we won't have time to talk about the biggest party in town next week. What is that? Well, Monday is the big bash to celebrate the opening of the new Riverfront Streetcar extension, and you're invited. In fact, it's a community picnic starting at 11 near the Berkeley Riverfront Park. They're calling it a major milestone, but this is actually just 3/4 of a mile, Charlie. What difference does that really make?
This makes a big difference in the city's long process of reconnecting the riverfront and getting people down to the riverfront and trying to rejuvenate that part of town. And so now this, fun, touristic-y kind of travel option down to the riverfront might get more people down there to the restaurants, to the current games.
Yes, because it's going to be steps from the stadium.
Exactly.
And there's been a lot of anxiety over parking there.
Oh,
this
yeah.
will make it a little easier.
Sure.
Well, this has been part of the Current's long-term plan from the start, is they have a relatively small amount of parking spots at their new stadium. And that was because they want it to be a more walkable, transit-oriented stadium than every other one in Kansas City. However, in the first few years of them playing at that stadium, they had to essentially run school buses and shuttle buses between parking spaces downtown that people would streetcar to and to the stadium. Other people would walk through the town of Kansas Bridge. Now, alongside this streetcar extension is also a pedestrian and bike bridge that is a little closer toward the stadium and towards that part of the Berkeley Riverfront Park than the town of Kansas Bridge is. It makes it, there's more options now to get down to the riverfront than there were before.
I think the real test, Nick, is what happens next. You know, right now, at the end of that streetcar line, there's a hotel, there's a couple of restaurants, both connected to the hotel, actually. Will we see more development? Will there be more reason to go down there other than the soccer stadium and that one set of businesses that people actually get excited about going to? That's what we're waiting to see.
We also have to remember that this is also, this month, the 10th anniversary of the entire streetcar line. And I found a wonderful quote I wanted to mention here. It says, Kansas City's best moments usually start with people saying it can't be done, and if you try, it will fail. Is this something that actually worked, and has it exceeded the expectations of all those critics at the beginning, Dave?
I think it's worked on its own terms. I mean, at one point, then-Mayor Emanuel Cleaver called it touristy frou-frou, and it is kind of that. I mean, it isn't a mass transit vehicle. It's a way for people to get now from the plaza down to the river and back the other way. So on those terms, yes, it's been successful. It's been expensive. We've spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the streetcar and continue to do so. But it's hard to find people who are highly critical of the project, and there is, as we've said repeatedly here, more talk about expanding
it. But I remember all those people who said it would kill Main Street, and now we've just got one development after another on that street.
I think it works as a spine to connect Main Street from now the riverfront down to the plaza, and as it's expanded, it's become less of a tourist vehicle where people from the suburbs or from out of town who are coming in for a conference would ride between Union Station and the City Market. As it's gone down through Midtown, it's become more of a public transit vehicle. It's used by more locals, I would say. I'd see those percentages rising than they have been in the past. However, just as it's expanded now 6.5 miles in 10 years, I would caution viewers who are excited about the streetcar to remember that it will take just about that long to get another extension, whether that's east to west or further north. Building a streetcar, building rail as public transit takes a very long time. You have to do studies, you have to get funding, and then it takes a long time in construction. That all will take almost a decade from start to finish rather than putting a bus on a street. And I think the focus on streetcar expansions really shows where the city's priorities are in public transit rather than, you know, bus mass transit, which is right now struggling for a lack of regional funding.
Was Kansas City Mayor Quinton Lucas watching our show last week when he asked, what on earth happened to those big plans? We asked that question to remake the Country Club Plaza. Well, we got word. And we should expect major action from the council this week on jump-starting a $1.5 billion transformation of the historic shopping district. So how come we didn't hear that much new, rather than seeing new timelines for cranes and construction crews to start work on the plaza? The debate bogged down once again on the height of buildings and whether the plaza can privatize sidewalks, a move critics fear could be used to push out protesters and street musicians. We've heard it all before. Was I wrong to expect something more?
No, I mean, what the council is deciding on right now is another change to the high minimums that were fought about earlier, and privatizing the sidewalks to give the plaza, what they say, more control over making it more walkable, more pedestrian-friendly, although council has some fears about that from a security standpoint, and as one council member put it, from a First Amendment standpoint, since the plaza is where a lot of protesters go to gather. I think what we should be paying attention to more than these ordinances, which would dictate sort of the vibe and the look of the plaza, is when the tax financing and tax breaks for the plaza come in through council and through the Port Authority of Kansas City, because those are what are really highly contested, is giving away so much money to this developer who initially said they were going to save the plaza themselves.
I was expecting that sort of finance plan this week. Was that expecting too much? I mean, I think most members of the public want to know, they want to do all these things. Great. Who pays for it?
Much like the stadium, the Royal Stadium, you need to generate revenue through the activity in the plaza or at the stadium to provide all the tax breaks and subsidies and incentives that they're going to get. And so you need to do something to get more bodies onto the streets, and I think they think this is the way to do it.
Now, Friday is adjournment day in Jefferson City, and Missouri lawmakers are scrambling to squeeze in a final burst of legislation before heading home. The big ticket items are already done, like the state budget and a plan to phase out Missouri's income tax. We'll now head to voters for final approval. But what happened to some of the stories that have impact on Kansas City? Can we get a quick answers on these headline grabbers? For instance, did lawmakers follow through and block Kansas City from banning mini liquor bottles, or did that not go anywhere?
We haven't seen that go anywhere there. No.
Okay. So that's going to stay the same. How about on the property tax? We saw the Jackson County executive reach out to Mike Keogh asking lawmakers to have a property freeze for 2 years. That would be popular with voters. Did anything happening with that?
Nothing happened with that. Phil Lovato made that request a little late in the session, is what I've heard from lawmakers, for them to actually act on that. But having both parties say that that was a priority, and with the very real possibility, as we tape this, that there won't be any action by the end of the session on property tax relief, really is quite, will go down as one of the major disappointments of the session.
Now, how about changes to Missouri's Stand Your Ground law after the Jackson County prosecutor argued she had to drop murder charges against two men involved in the chief's rally shooting? Remember that? In fact, both men were released from state custody this week, 2 years after the murder of Lisa Galvin at the chief's victory rally outside of Union Station.
Yeah, I mean, so again, there's been no progress on that. I think, you know, the idea that the chief's rally shooting would have motivated Republican lawmakers to change the Stand Your Ground law was far-fetched anyway.
Okay.
I mean, they confirmed as much to reporters towards the end of the session. But also, I think the Republicans are sort of calling what they believe is Melissa Johnson's bluff and saying that it doesn't harm any prosecution for shootings like this. Melissa Johnson, however, is saying that her hands are tied in these cases and she has no choice but to offer a plea deal because the Stand Your Ground law case is so easy to apply in these instances, even when others may think it doesn't matter.
But it seems to be, so you get an awful lot of bashing on social media, though. There we go again. We're being soft on crime in Kansas City.
Right, yeah. And so she was looking for a little backup, but the folks from Jefferson City said, no, you have the power. They really feel like she could move forward with some of these charges if she wanted to.
And we will be heading home, by the way. They'll be heading home when we record this program, when you'll see this program on Friday night, so we'll find out the eventual details of that session by this weekend. Now, when you put a program like this together every week, you can't get to every story grabbing the headlines. What was the big local story we missed? It's finally happening. Arrowhead stripped of all its signage as the Chiefs get ready to hand over the keys to FIFA on Sunday. Groundbreaking on that contentious AI center in Independence. Meanwhile, Johnson County now in the spotlight as Edgerton considers a mega data center just days after a similar proposal was rejected in the city of Gardner. Three people exposed to hantavirus taken to KU Hospital for observation. Despite the fear-fueling headlines, local health leaders claim the risk to the public is low. Graduation postponed at Bishop Ward High School in KCK after a significant part of the senior class apparently vandalized the school.
Seniors pulled a prank. They destroyed several classrooms and they caused a lot of damage. They upturned tables, threw eggs. They ripped up textbooks, threw them down the stairs, and they destroyed brand new furniture in their resource center.
And the Berlin Wall, or at least parts of it, have finally arrived at Union Station. It's their latest blockbuster exhibition, opening to the public May 29th. stories, Savannah. Did you pick one of those stories or something completely different this week?
I picked something else. Viewers may remember 3 years ago, way back during one of the coldest weeks of the year, tenants in a northeast apartment complex on North Long Avenue had no heat. And then they organized through KC Tenants and months later got huge protections, and including a rent subsidy from the city. They were some of the most protected tenants in Missouri. That deal is running out, and now they've expanded their union to have a 94% supermajority on all the properties their landlord owns on that street, and they're asking for a better deal as they're facing rent increases.
Brian.
I'm watching the case of the former mayor of Coldwater, Kansas, Joe Ceballos, who was a permanent legal resident, but who believed incorrectly that he was entitled to vote and to run for office. He was elected mayor. In an agreement a few months ago, he resigned and pleaded guilty to a lesser offense and had a suspended sentence, and thought the matter was resolved. This week, ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, detained him and now is beginning proceedings that could result in his deportation. He's lived in the country for decades, even was elected to public office, but he too is caught up in the current effort to deport.
But he did vote illegally.
He did vote illegally, though he says that he didn't know that was the case.
Charlie.
I'm going with a story that involves Brian Platt, the former city manager. At Thursday's city council meeting, they're introducing yet another settlement for a case brought against Brian Platt in the city for $500,000.
So perhaps if you're don't get your snow removed next year, you'll know that the money that might have been spent on that was spent on the lawsuit settlement.
You could argue that.
Dave.
Our buddy Eric Wesson will have more complaints about snow removal going forward. You mentioned earlier the Missouri vote on income tax, phasing out the income tax, replacing it with a broader-based sales tax at some point. A lawsuit has been filed against that proposal as well. Keep your eye on that, because it's likely, possible, perhaps likely, that the income tax question will go on the August ballot.
And on that, we will say our week has been reviewed, courtesy of KCY's Savannah Hawley-Bates and Charlie Keegan from Channel 41, KCY's Brian Ellison, a news icon and Mr. Kansas City Stack on Substack, Dave Helling. Next week on the program, we bring you the top decision makers of the World Cup, just as Kansas Cityans are showing heightened anxiety and concern about what's about to happen. The police chief, the head of the World Cup committee, and the city manager together in one room. Would you join us? Until then, from all of us here at Kansas City PBS, be well, keep calm, and carry on.